This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 7th of July, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, Chinese officials finally admit to a massive oil spill 1 month after the first leak started. India's AIDS Prevention Agency officially recognizes the country's transgender community. And in Washington, progressives push for cuts in military spending as lawmakers continue to argue over the debt ceiling.
With the Republicans, don't touch the military, don't touch Homeland Security, don't touch the Department of Defense, but do touch Social Security, do touch Medicare, Medicaid. So that's the hypocrisy.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Court of Appeals today overturned an FCC ruling allowing one company to own a newspaper and broadcast outlet in the same market. The court also ruled the FCC failed to consider the impact of broader media ownership rules on minorities and women. In a release, the plaintiff in the case, Prometheus Radio Project, calls this ruling a victory on almost every point. Hundreds of pro-Palestinian activists are expected to land at Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport tomorrow. In response, Israeli authorities have mobilized security forces and have asked foreign airlines to ban the activists from their flights. FSRN's Jillian Kessler-Domore reports from Israel.
Hundreds of activists from across Europe, Africa, and the U.S. plan to fly into Tel Aviv Airport within the next 24 hours. The activists are part of the Welcome to Palestine initiative, which has been planning the action since March. The Israeli media reported Thursday that 600 Israeli police officers will be deployed at the airport. The Israeli Ministry of Interior also reportedly sent letters to airlines asking them to bar activists from flying into Israel. The Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem has been working with the protesters. It released an email sent from a Swiss airline to one of the activists reading, "The Israeli Ministry of the Interior has refused your entry into their territory. For this reason, your reservation has been cancelled." AIC co-director Connie Hackbarth.
"I'm horrified that Israel is outsourcing its occupation and that countries such as Canada, Greece, Switzerland are agreeing to take part in continuing the Israeli occupation, in this case by not allowing peace activists to come. I hope that peace activists will turn to their own governments and protest this complicity in the Israeli occupation."
The first of approximately 50 flights carrying the activists are expected to land early Friday morning. Jillian Kessler-Domore, FSRN, Jerusalem.
New information has emerged from investigations into the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Fast and Furious program. The program was intended to track U.S.-sold weapons along the Mexico border in order to secure arrests, but many of the weapons were lost along the way. FSRN's Shannon Young has more.
The pretense of the Fast and Furious program was to allow straw purchases of weapons, track the guns, and identify the higher-ups supplying them to crime syndicates in Mexico. Whistleblowing field agents have come forward saying they were ordered not to intervene at moments they thought were critical in preventing future crimes. Since then, several guns traced to the program have been linked to crimes in both the United States and Mexico. The controversy has sparked calls for the resignation of ATF Director Kenneth Melson. But according to testimony given by Melson in private to congressional investigators, the inquiries should look beyond the ATF. A letter sent this week to Attorney General Eric Holder by Congressmembers Daryl Issa and Charles Grassley outlined some of the key points of the meeting with the ATF director. The congressmembers wrote they have, quote, "very real indications from several sources that some of the gun trafficking higher-ups that the ATF sought to identify were already known to other agencies and may even have been paid as informants." The agencies named in the letter are the FBI and the DEA. Both are agencies that, like ATF, fall under the umbrella of the Department of Justice. Shannon Young, FSRN.
Many residents of New Orleans and the surrounding parishes are still struggling to rebuild their homes more than 5 years after Hurricane Katrina and faulty levees devastated the city. The challenge of rebuilding has been particularly difficult for some lower-income minority homeowners who were often given far less federal help than residents from wealthy neighborhoods. A discrimination lawsuit settled Wednesday with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development aimed to address this issue. FSRN's Zoe Sullivan has more from New Orleans.
The case alleged that Louisiana's Road Home program, which aimed to help homeowners rebuild after Hurricane Katrina, used a discriminatory formula to calculate awards. Grants were based either on a home's pre-storm value or the cost of rebuilding, whichever was lower. Because of this, homeowners from low-income neighborhoods often didn't receive sufficient money to rebuild. In the wake of the storm, largely African-American neighborhoods like the Lower Ninth Ward and New Orleans East have struggled. The Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center says that under the settlement, more than 13,000 homeowners will now receive full compensation. More than $60 million in additional grants will be allocated to help the rebuilding process. Additionally, the agreement grants homeowners more time to rebuild without the threat of foreclosure. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
And finally, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals says the U.S. military must stop enforcing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Last November, a federal judge ruled that the policy was unconstitutional and ordered it stopped. Upon appeal, the court stayed the ruling, but yesterday lifted that stay, meaning the ban on Don't Ask, Don't Tell would once again be in effect. In its ruling, the court cited the recent opinion of the Justice Department saying laws targeting gays and lesbians must be held to heightened scrutiny. In the order, the court said the arguments to keep the discriminatory policy in place do not hold up to the new higher standard. The case will be heard by the court in late August. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In China's Bohai Sea, one of the busiest waterways in the world, the full details of a major oil spill are slowly coming to light. The China National Offshore Oil Corporation and U.S. oil giant ConocoPhillips have finally admitted that two leaks occurred last month from their Peng Lai operation, one of the country's largest offshore oil fields. The director of China's State Oceanic Administration said yesterday that the spills polluted an area of more than 300 square miles and that there are still small leaks. He said there'll be a long-term impact on the marine environment, but gave few details. This public admission comes more than a month after the first leak on June the 4th. At a news conference yesterday, ConocoPhillips said authorities were immediately notified when the accidents occurred. Carlin Robertson, Executive Vice President of ConocoPhillips China Operations, described how the second leak happened.
On June 17th, there was an incident on Platform C during the drilling of a well. A well kick occurred when a high-pressure zone was encountered. A leak of oil and gas was observed during this time. A decision was made to pump cement in the well and secure it. This operation was safely performed and the well secured in approximately 48 hours.
The company said the exact role of ConocoPhillips in causing the leak is still being investigated. Environmental groups have slammed the government for its lack of transparency and are demanding information about how much oil leaked and its impact on the environment. Meanwhile, on the Yellowstone River in Montana, another oil spill cleanup continues after an ExxonMobil pipeline ruptured on Friday near the town of Laurel, dumping about 1,000 barrels or 42,000 gallons of crude oil into the river. Gary Pruessing, president of ExxonMobil Pipeline Company, spoke to reporters at a conference call earlier this week.
The ExxonMobil Pipeline Company truly regrets the incident that has occurred here in the Yellowstone River. We certainly take our responsibilities for safety and integrity in operating our systems very seriously. And we, again, I want to apologize to everybody in the state of Montana for the issues that we've created here. We are certainly committed to be here and to respond to the event and be here until all of the cleanup is complete.
An unconfirmed number of people were taken to local hospitals with dizziness and breathing problems from toxic fumes, and local municipal water supplies were temporarily stopped as a safety precaution during the hours following the accident. Miles of shoreline have been polluted, and wildlife officials are searching for affected animals. Farmer Alexis Bonagovsky told the Billings Gazette that oil from the spill seeped into one of their pastures.
It was concentrating around trees, around vegetation. There was a sheen of it on top of the water. And so when I was walking, we have video of it, when I was walking, we were just walking through brown sheets of oil.
The EPA is overseeing the cleanup and conducting air and water tests and says more than 400 responders are on the scene. As the president and congressional leaders try to hammer out a deal to raise the nation's debt ceiling, the U.S. House is currently debating whether to spend another $500 billion on the military. Matt Laszlo reports that the Progressive Caucus wants military spending to be cut as a part of any deal.
President Obama is reportedly now looking to cut around $4 trillion from the nation's debt as a part of a deal to raise the debt ceiling. The Washington Post reports that he wants to find some of those savings in Social Security and Medicare. A group of progressive House members, including California Democratic Congressperson Judy Chu, sent the president a letter asking him to take all cuts to entitlements off the table.
Those on the other side of the aisle believe that cutting benefits to seniors is the only way we can solve our default crisis, but I say that there are other ways.
This week, the House is debating a bill to fund the Pentagon at $530 billion, a $17 billion increase for the agency at a time when the House has voted to cut funding for women, children, and schools. Texas Democratic Congressperson Sheila Jackson Lee says as a part of negotiations to reduce the deficit, the military ought to cut its share.
I think that the Pentagon has to be on the table.
In his Twitter town hall on Wednesday, President Obama was asked about cutting military spending. He said it's not that easy.
We can't simply lop off 25% off the defense budget overnight. We have to think about all the obligations we have to our current troops who are in the field and making sure they're properly equipped and safe. We've got to make sure that we are meeting our commitments for those veterans who are coming home.
Democrats, like Congressperson Jackson Lee, say they aren't looking to cut 25% from the Pentagon budget. She says if the nation is looking to cut trillions of dollars in spending, the military needs to be on the table and the wars ought to be reassessed.
Iraq should be over now. Afghanistan should be over now. In and of itself, those are savings. I think our military should be retooled. I think our young men and women should come home and be engaged in military preparedness. They are tired. It is a long time. We need to get them retooled. We need our new technology in weaponry, if you will. I'm not afraid of that. And I think there are many Democrats who understand that. But I'm not a warmonger either. And so I believe that we are in two wars that are long overdue. And even the hanging on in Iraq is absurd.
Included in the House debate is funding for the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Their price tag is more than $118 billion for the two conflicts, an increase by the Republican majority of nearly $1 billion from the president's request. Arizona Democratic Congressperson Raul Grijalva says the GOP is trying to have it both ways in calling for trillions of dollars in spending cuts, but not touching tax policy.
That's kind of the hypocrisy. With the Republicans, don't touch the military, don't touch Homeland Security, don't touch the Department of Defense. But do touch Social Security, do touch Medicare, and do touch Medicaid. So that's the hypocrisy, that if all things were on the table, I think you wouldn't have the kind of concern that we have, because at least everything would be discussed equally.
Grijalva says he and the rest of the Progressive Caucus want any budget cuts to be fair and spread across the board.
In the balancing process, that's not on the table now. We really feel it's essential it be on the table as well.
President Obama and congressional leaders failed to reach an agreement on the debt ceiling after meeting Thursday. The president says he'll be reconvening with congressional leaders on Sunday to see if the two sides can reach a deal to keep the nation from defaulting on its debt. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
You're listening to FSRN. Stay with us. Today we begin the first of a two-part series on the world's melting ice formations, and we start by listening to the sound of glacial ice melt. London-based artist Katie Patterson recorded melting glaciers in Iceland. She then took meltwater from each of the glaciers, combined that with silicon and pressed them into records, which she played on turntables until they completely melted, a process that took nearly 2 hours. Scientists are also raising concerns about the rapid pace of ice melt. A recent study of Greenland's ice sheet found that it's melting at the fastest rate since records began in 1979. A team of scientists using remote sensing data, surface observations, and models found that melting in some areas last year continued for more than a month longer than average. Dr. Marco Tedesco is director of the Cryospheric Processes Laboratory in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at City College of New York. He co-authored the study. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Good morning and hello, everybody.
I understand you were camping at a 1 kilometre wide superglacial lake to measure your data. You chose that site from maps, but I understand because of the melting, when you got there, it actually looked quite different to how it had appeared on your maps.
We had a big surprise when we arrived to the lakes that we selected from our maps, that they were gone much sooner than we expected by the end of June. And so we had to pick up this lake by eye from the helicopter, and actually it turned out to be a much better lake for our studies. And we had all this, satellite record, which was showing us the extent from the previous years and this year. And the year where we were, basically 2010, was an exceptional year in terms of the extent and the depth of the lake, which was draining also from one of the major streams through Tremulen on the side.
Can you just explain why these superglacial lakes are such an important part of your study into melting?
Well, there are a few reasons. First of all, surface of the ice sheet is strongly affected by the presence of water, because water is much darker than the ice, and it can absorb more solar radiation. So it happens what we call a positive feedback mechanism, in which the presence of water on the ice accelerates the production of melt water because of the more solar radiation absorbed. The other important feature is, of course, because we quantify the amount of water that is stored on the ice, that will tell us somehow how much that is connected to increasing surface melt water. So, of course, these big lakes are like witnesses of how much water is produced or through melt water. And ultimately, because there is an intimate link between the surface of the ice sheet and its bedrock, where the ice meets the rock, because this water can drain through the superglacial lakes either in a violent manner through, crack that allows lakes to drain within 80 minutes. Think about like this lake, 1 kilometer wide and 5-6 meters deep on the average, draining in about 80 minutes. It's a very strong and very fast event. Or through streams where the water from this lake is directed by the pressure of the water, and they ultimately this water flows through a crack, and it meets the bedrock by connecting, by expanding what we call the subglacial system, which is nothing else than a series of pipes into the ice created by this water. The importance of this water below the ice is due to the fact that the pressure of this water and the presence of the water can eventually accelerate the ice sheet toward its path to the ocean. And so it's not it's like the surface processes affecting also subsurface processes of the ice.
So you mentioned there that there can be quite a contrast in terms of how rapidly this melts and what it looks like. So as you're sitting there watching this melt, were you seeing collapsing ice structures? What sort of things are you observing?
We saw the lake filling at a very fast pace, and we were witnessing the stream of this lake flowing into one very large crack. We're talking about a crack that is about a kilometer long, that at a certain point opens up, and because of the presence of the water, it starts getting larger and larger, and there's literally this fall coming from the lake that is flowing into this crack. And we were not witnessing any collapse or any drainage of the lake. And it's very rare, because it happens so fast that unless you're there at exactly that moment, what you'll find when you arrive, which we also did actually in other lakes, you'll find the debris of ice that has been lifted up by the violent event. and you're sitting in a pond of water. It can be an extremely dangerous event if you are actually in the water, and there are also some collateral events that are like ice quakes, and the lift up of the ice sheet can be pretty dramatic.
So how concerned do you think we should be by this record melt?
Well, prediction for surface temperature is, of course, the trend is an increase in surface temperature over Greenland, and the overall message, the overall point is that we have to start thinking about not in linear terms in terms of increasing surface temperature, increasing melting as we know it. We need to account for the fact that increasing surface temperature means accelerating also surface melting, not linearly accelerated, by an exponential, let's say, acceleration of melting, because other factors such as, again, bare ice exposure, or in case of small accumulation, sooner bare ice exposure, are playing a great and important, a crucial factor for accelerating melting. On the long term, if this trend continues, of course, melting will accelerate, especially along the coast, as has been predicted by many models from the IPCC.
Dr. Marco Tedesco, Director of the Cryospheric Processes Laboratory at City College of New York, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tomorrow, in the second part of our series on the world's melting ice formations, we'll look at how stronger ocean currents are speeding the melting beneath Antarctica's glacier ice shelf. And to find out more information about the glacier ice melt recording we played earlier in the broadcast, go to our website, fsrn.org. India's National AIDS Control Program, the NACP, has officially recognized the country's transgender community and is now preparing to incorporate them into its program. The transgender community in India has long been considered a high-risk group by the NACP due to the high percentage of their members involved in sex work, and it took the country's AIDS prevention body over 10 years to recognize the sexual minority as a separate group. From Mumbai, Gayatri Lakshimbai reports.
Hijras are a community of transgender people native to the Indian subcontinent. They distinguish themselves from transgenders around the world based on their community life. Hijra communities are rooted in ancient traditions and follow a strict hierarchy. Every house of Hijras has a guru or a mentor at the top and many chelas or disciples under her. These age-old traditions still thrive even in a global economic hub like Mumbai. Simran belongs to a sect of Hijras that is considered divine according to Hindu mythology.
We have a very strong mentor-disciple bond in our community. I share the same relationship with my guru that a mother shares with her daughter. My parents gave birth to me, but my guru adopted me. If she asks for my life, I have to give her my life. I don't feel this way for my parents. What keeps us together is the deity we follow. We embrace the idols of the deities and go around town asking for money every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. We take whatever people give us. We don't demand anything. We give a share of whatever money we earn this way to our guru.
Simran has stuck to this kind of begging on the streets to earn her livelihood. But when begging isn't enough, many Hijras are pushed into sex work. According to a recent report released by the National AIDS Control Organization, or NACO, 47% of the Hijra population are sex workers. Ankita is a Hijra who runs the AIDS prevention program in a Mumbai-based NGO called Hamsafa Trust. She says Hijras have little choice because of the lack of educational and employment opportunities.
Even if I go begging to a shopkeeper and ask for a few rupees, he'll say to me, forget these 2-3 rupees. Here, take 20 rupees and come inside the shop. Then even the Hijra thinks, if I beg at 100 shops, I'll probably earn 100 rupees. But if I get a couple of customers here, I could make more money. This is how vulnerable they are. Add this to the way everyone views them in society. That's why there's such a high number of Hijra sex workers today.
Being a sexual minority involved in sex work makes the Hijra population a high-risk group for contracting HIV/AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases. Though precise estimates are difficult to make, A survey conducted in 2005 indicated that 40% of Hijra sex workers were affected by HIV. Shalu, a Hijra, has been a sex worker for the past decade.
ऐसा होता है कि हम घर पे जब तक रहते हैं तो हमारे परिवार वाले फैमिली वाले तो जो भी जरूरतें लगती हैं सब कुछ पूरा करते हैं.
When I was at home, my family would take care of all of my needs. But once I left home, I faced many problems with meeting my daily needs. Sex work among the Hijras is well-paying. You can earn between 500 and 1,000 rupees for 2 hours of work. That helps in meeting daily expenses. But the health risks are way more when you are involved in sex work. If you have 10 customers, it's very likely that 5 of them have some kind of sexually transmitted disease. I've suffered from STDs twice, but I recovered with medication.
Currently, nearly all medical assistance to Hijra sex workers is offered by NGOs working in the field. However, their efforts aren't enough to curb the occurrence of sexually transmitted diseases among the large group. Lakshmi Tripathi is a prominent Hijra activist who runs her own NGO, Astitva, which assists the community on various levels. She is also part of the planning committee of the National AIDS Control Program, which recently recognized transgenders and Hijras as a separate group. She says this recognition is an important step in the implementation of the next phase of the National AIDS Program, which aims to have targeted interventions among the community's sex workers.
National AIDS Control Society of India, which is a part of the Health Ministry. When we started way back in 1999, we were under the club of men having sex with men. And there I stood up and I said, excuse me, I'm not a man. The government is not to decide my gender and my sexuality. It's my basic human right to decide who am I. So it was necessary to address the issues of the Hijras differently. And after 10 years now, the fourth phase of the National AIDS Program of India, it is decided that the Hijras and transgender will be a complete different group. There is success.
As part of the program, which begins in April 2012, AIDS prevention efforts will be focused in areas with higher populations of Hijras. These measures will be adopted in conjunction with existing NGOs and community-based organizations that work in the field. The goal of the nationwide program is to bring down HIV infections among the community by 50%. This particular move aims to erase the stigma around being a Hijra sex worker. And with more acceptance from society, advocates hope more Hijras will be proactive about their sexual health. Gayatri Lakshmi Bai, FSRN, Mumbai.
And that's the program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments and news tips. Write to us, comments at fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.